Well, that is Joanne Shenandoah's marvelous CD, Matriarch. And I thought it was so appropriate for the guest we have with us on the line right now. I'm so happy to welcome, actually, back to the Women's Show. She's been a wonderful guest many times here, Dr. Sally Rush Wagner. I believe she was one of the first women to receive a doctorate in this country for work in women's studies from University of California, Santa Cruz. She was a founder of one of the first college-level women's studies programs at CSU Sacramento. She taught women's studies, etc., but had a life-changing experience, actually, with Matilda Joshlin Gage, actually pursuing her doctorate. And she now is the CEO and head of the Matilda Joshlin Gage Institute. She is the foundation, Matilda Joshlin Gage Foundation. So, Sally Rush Wagner, welcome so much to the Women's Show.
Thank you, Mary. It's wonderful to be back.
Well, it is always so good to have you because during Women's History Month, we like to kind of focus on some of the extraordinary leaders we've had. And Matilda Joshlin Gage, the more I get into her, and thanks a lot to you. I mean, I was aware of Matilda Joshlin Gage before, but I really didn't know that much about her. And I think really thanks to you, I've gone back. I'm reading parts of her Women, Church, and State. And wow, I think really that she's probably one of the best minds, male or female, I have ever come across.
Oh, that's so excited that you're reading her again. I keep rereading Woman, Church, and State and find more. And I think, you would probably agree with Gloria Steinem, who said that Gage was the woman who was ahead of the women who were ahead of their time.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that because I think one more and more appreciates really the scope of her vision and how she really framed her entire life the battle for human rights, which she was most focused for, women's rights, because she also was aware of the problems of her Native American neighbors, and she totally understood the irony of the government trying to impose citizenship on them at the same time that she's being, and Susan B. Anthony are being arrested for trying to be a citizen. I mean, Gage just understood this.
Yeah, and she understood it from her own experience, both knowing Haudenosaunee people, but also she was adopted into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation in 1893. She had supported for years treaty rights and sovereignty and pointed out, as you said, the contradiction that the government was denying citizenship to its women who were demanding it. At the same time, it was trying to force citizenship on Indian men, the better to steal their lands, she said. So when she was adopted in 1893 and given a name, a real name, she writes to her daughter and says, "My Mohawk sisters are considering me for a position in the Council of Matrons, which would give me a say in the choosing of the chief." The women, the clan mother nominates, and the women's council is, a major part of deciding if the nomination will be accepted. And so here she is offered the possibility of citizenship, or I wouldn't say citizenship, but I would say a voice in the government of this nation into which she's adopted. At the same time, that same year, she's arrested for voting in a school board election in her village, her own hometown village of Fayetteville, New York. And I think that understanding what she said was justice to the Indians requires living up to the treaties that we have with them. And that's about as good as anybody can say today.
Well, yeah, and I think it might be surprising to people, unless they really have been students, particularly of women's history, to realize that Mexican women who own lands, as we push west, that actually they held far more rights, the rights to own property, the rights to vote, etc., that they had to give up or else leave this country when it was, became part of the continental United States. And so, but, and I think we need to review the history, the grand triumvirate, if you will, or the quad, actually, of Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, but Matilda Joslyn Gage. But then I think we're going to kind of quickly do that because I really want to get in to, because I've really become so impressed with Gage's understanding that this battle was much deeper even than national citizenship to women. That, in essence, she really had the vision to realize that she was fighting for the legitimacy of women's to exist. You know, as full citizens, as full human beings. And I kind of want to get into that because I think that is so important to us right now. But real quickly, you know, there the when in the course of human events it becomes necessary. But who would have thought that the only people they were referring to were white propertied men, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, just real quickly take us through abolition and how forcefully, you know, that Gage was committed to that and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, et cetera. And what happened in their fights for abolition when they didn't have a voice to even speak at the international conventions?
Well, I think with Gage, we begin with her childhood. The home she grew up in, the station on the Underground Railroad. Her father was one of the founders of the Liberty Party, the very first anti-slavery party in the country. And she said she thought she was born with a hatred of oppression. She was circulating anti-slavery petitions when she was 10. She was absolutely committed to the cause. And probably every home that she lived in throughout her life had been a station or was offered as the station. We know that her home in Fayetteville, which we're now restoring, the Gage Foundation, and turning it into a center for social justice thought, we know that that home was a station. We have evidence of that. And she said, it was the proudest moment of my life when the head of the Underground Railroad in Syracuse came to her door and said, will you offer? And she said, of course I will. She faced 6 months in prison and a $1,000 fine for doing that. Interestingly, it doesn't appear that Stanton and her husband ever offered their home in nearby Seneca Falls as a station on the Underground Railroad. I'm not sure why that was. And, of course, Anthony's home in Rochester, they moved into after the Civil War, the family home in Rochester. So for the three, the big three, the triumvirate of the women's rights movement, we're the one Underground Railroad home. In terms of the abolition movement and the connection between women's rights and abolition, the two were absolutely inseparable, the two movements were. And it wasn't until the 14th and 15th Amendment, the adoption of male suffrage or the vote for black men only with the 15th Amendment and the 14th Amendment, which used the word male in connection with citizenship for the first time in the Constitution. Before then, the Constitution was gender neutral. And that's the point at which there was a break between the two.
Yeah, and it very interesting break, and so let's go into that a little bit because you have Frances Willard and the Women's Temperance Movement, but there's a little deeper involvement, which is terribly related right now, that they actually, hello, Sally?
Yes.
Oh, good. We had a little Fritz there, that actually they really were within a hair's breadth of turning this into a Christian nation.
And this happens later. I think increasingly Anthony came to see during the 70s and the 80s and into the late 80s, Anthony increasingly narrowed her focus. And she thought, we've really got to get a victory. Let's go just for the vote and drop all these other issues that we're dealing with. Well, for Gage, there were a multitude of other issues. There were for the National Women's Suffrage Association, the whole movement. And Gage really thought all of those issues needed to be addressed. Everything from reproductive rights to equal pay for equal work. But as Anthony narrowed her focus, Stanton and Gage turned more toward looking at the church. And they said, you know, we've got to figure out the underpinnings of our oppression. Where does this idea come from? And both of them pointed to the teachings of religion that woman was made for man, and the story of Eve, that woman was responsible for sin, therefore she was to be under the authority of her husband. And, you know, the Bible repeats that message, that lesson throughout all the way into the New Testament. And they said, that's what we've got to deal with. You know, until we turn religion into a liberating force rather than a force of oppression of one group or another, we're never going to have freedom for everybody. That was Gage's vision. Now, Anthony said, let's focus on the vote and let's work with anybody who wants to get the vote. We don't care what their reason is. Well, Frances Willard and the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the conservative Christian women wanted to get the vote for women in order to create a theocracy. They wanted to put God in the Constitution, establish Jesus Christ as the head of the government, and, you know, who would decide what God wanted? Well, apparently the fundamentalists would. And Gates said, you know, if we lose religious freedom, it's not going to matter who votes. That is the great danger of the hour. She and Anthony had a conflict over the direction of the movement. Gage lost. Anthony merged the two organizations, brought in the Women's Christian Temperance Union. The two suffrage organizations became increasingly, in this merged effort, increasingly more conservative. So by 1895, when Stanton edits the Woman's Bible, Gage is a contributor to it, the organization that Stanton was the very first president of, this merged organization, and the National American Woman Suffrage Association dissociates itself, just essentially, you know, disses this whole work of Stanton. At the same time, they're not saying anything about the Christian writings of Frances Willard. You know, they don't want to have any association with the Woman's Bible. It's just too radical for them. And when the following year, they allow one of the southern state organizations to discriminate against black women, to exclude black women and practice segregation. And Gage dropped out of the movement when that merger happened. She said, you know, we were workers for women's rights because we wanted freedom. These new women are workers for the right to vote because they want to destroy freedom, destroy religious freedom. And she went on to form her own organization that fought for the separation of church and state and fought against religious fundamentalism. And she went out of history as the increasingly conservative suffrage movement really didn't want to have anything to do with this radical woman as part of their past.
Oh, you know, I think as one goes along, I think one is more appreciative that really one of the real rock foundations of this democracy is a freedom of religion, or a freedom from religion, if you will. And Matilda Joslyn Gage really understood that from the word go.
And the irony is that she's standing firmly in the tradition of the founding fathers. You know, she's on the shoulders of Thomas Jefferson. In her work, in that belief that religious freedom underlies every other freedom in this country.
Yeah, and I think particularly in these times right now, I think one really becomes very appreciative of her awareness of the real necessities of certain basic freedoms, or frankly, the others will all be denied. And, you know, I hadn't really given credence to the freedom of religion being so important to this country until, I think, you know, the last, say, 20 years, when it really, frankly, I think, well, we've seen the real problems that, you know, that it's not the merits of various religions, but the problem is the interpretation of the religious dictates. And so no matter how kind or benevolent, that is always open to the latest interpretation.
Yes, the problem.
Yeah.
And I think losing Gage, we lose that history of resistance to that tyranny.
Yeah. And you know, I just find just the fierceness of her intellect. And you know, because I have to admit, you know, I've always thought, you know, 70 years of denying us, you know, fighting so hard for the vote. You know, I think I saw that as the machinations of politics. And I really knew sexism. But I really, until Gage, I really hadn't stopped to think about what a fundamental battle this was, you know, against, so to speak, organized religions who did prevail, that it was important to have women in a secondary subservient role, and that really this is what Gage really had the vision to take on.
And woman, church, and state, like you, Mary, each time I read it, I'm renewed in my astonishment at the scope of her vision. She does, I think, for the relations of reproduction and reproduction of daily life. You know, who controls reproduction and who controls the reproduction of daily life? She does for those elements of existence what Marx did for the relations of production. And I think hers is a deeper, and I hesitate to say that because who could ever take on the thinking of Marx?
I don't know. I think Gage could.
To look at the relations of reproduction and the control of that, which she says is the fundamental function of religion. It's astonishing. I mean, that's a hard one to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, she understood the primacy of body, that if a woman does not control her body and all the ramifications of that, then she is not an autonomous human being.
And that's where her connection with indigenous people come in, because she understood that in indigenous culture, women were the absolute sovereigns of their bodies.
Yeah, and I think that's so interesting, you know, because we look and we think, well, yeah, there was, quotes, equality, but the women really couldn't be the chiefs. So, you know, that even though they're given authority over who is the chief, and then as you start going deeper into this, you're really quite aware that that really our understanding, if you will, of what does equality mean really is still pretty immature.
That's exactly what the conclusion I come to. It's the limitations of the concept of equality, because what it does is it keeps the institutions intact. And we just want a piece of the pie. I remember at one point, Flo Kennedy, early on in the second wave of feminism, said, "We don't want a piece of the pie. The pie itself is crap. You know, we gotta redo the pie." And I think that was what Gage was saying, was that, you know, we got to create a system where nobody has power over anybody else. We've got to establish an egalitarian system. And in the Civil War, when she gave the flag presentation speech to the local soldiers, the boys marching off to battle, she said, "You're fighting for freedom, and there will be no permanent peace until there is absolute equality for every group." Because what disturbs the peace, you know, what causes war? Inequality. And,
yeah.
So, and she lists off. She says, you know, there will be no permanent peace until there is absolute equality for, you know, rich and poor, men and women, black and white, native-born and immigrant. And we challenge kids to come to the Gage home today. We say, okay, given this definition, is the Civil War over yet?
Very good question.
To establish the conditions of permanent peace.
Oh, that's a very good question, because, you know, at that time, I think Lincoln and all the politicians were saying that this is not a battle, Civil War over slavery. This is about over dissolution of the Union. And Jocelyn Gage has the strength to stand up and say, don't, it's about slavery. It's about equality. That's what it's about.
She was essentially saying, Abraham Lincoln is totally wrong. Lincoln was saying at that point, but the war has nothing to do with slavery.
Yeah.
It has everything to do with preserving the Union. In the estimation of the abolitionists, Abraham Lincoln was at best highly overrated and at worst a terrible turncoat, you know, elected on an abolition ticket who did not push the abolition issue. You know, and there's a justification, you know, we had to save the Union, we had to keep everyone together, we had to do all these things, but the abolitionists didn't think highly of
it. Well, and
they were more more relenting, or they were more willing to accept him. But
She was such a visionary that, you know, I don't expect visionaries to really try and deal with all the compromises of the politics and the social. I expect them to burn through all that riffraff and go right to the core. And Matilda Joshlin Gage, my word, was a visionary. But yet in a very realistic, she's this marvelous combination, so many great thinkers, you kind of see them, kind of off in their ivory tower and just thinking. And so these ideas, they forge out of the milieu, so to speak, and thenceforth they are. But Matilda Joshlin Gage, and I don't know how much was the fact that she was a woman and dealt within the political and social limitations of being a woman then, in terms of, public speaking, running for office and all that kind of stuff, or whether it's just that she had a different approach to thinking. But I repeat, her mind just amazes me. It really does. And you realize that, even though the accruements change of our modernity, that really at the very bottom core, we're still dealing with the same aspects of trying to be free and have liberty to all human beings here.
I think you really pick up, Marianne, something I felt has been a major part of her brilliance, is that she was both the theoretician and the activist.
Yeah.
And the activism modified and clarified and produced her theory. It was that ongoing, dialectic of doing and then analyzing what that doing meant and then doing based on the analysis, and it very powerful, very effective. And I think in that way, different from Stanton and Anthony. I've looked a lot at the three of them. Anthony was really the activist. She was not a brilliant thinker. Stanton was a brilliant thinker, but she really hated to, she's not one more convention. No, I don't want to, she hated to do the day-to-day work of the organization. Gage was both. And I think the three of them, when they were working together, were a powerful trinity, if you will, because the triumvirate, people have called them, of the leadership of the National Woman Suffrage Association, because they represented all of those. When they challenged the government in 1876 with the presentation of the Declaration of Rights of Women, Gage and Stanton wrote the document, Gage and Anthony presented the document, and Gage wrote up the report and the history of the presentation. So, you have all three of them playing important roles, but Gage sort of being in the center of it.
And I think the thing that so amazes me about Gage is really because I've always, been a student somewhat of Native American history and just fascinated, with their heritage, et cetera. And, the more I look and see the effect and how Gage particularly, and Benjamin Franklin, so many others do learn from particularly the Iroquois Nation in that area, I've realized, that because one looks and you think, my word, the terrible destruction and just wiping out, so many tribes, languages, societies, etc. But yet in a very fundamental way, you realize that in spite of 200 plus years of really trying to assimilate them, shall we say, not necessarily wipe them out, but, between the battles and the smallpox and everything else, you realize that there is such a strength in so much of Native American heritage, spirituality, I don't know what to call it, but in essence, particularly now in one of our gravest hours in this country, I think that the visions that these people still hold in spite of everything that's happened to them here, I don't think I would be so appreciative of that if it not for a great intellect like a Gage, who has the capacity to translate and to show what they taught her in her transformation, if you will, I realize that they're very alive and well. And I'm not so sure if not for Gage, I would see it in that way. Am I making any sense to you?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that friends of mine from various nations have talked about how the major way that they're understood is in the past tense, and absolutely very present today. And the issues are still going on. The treaty rights and sovereignty issues are being fought out in the courts every single day, and it's sort of the underbelly of history being made, and invisibly, being made invisibly. Most of us aren't aware of the court cases on treaties that are just ongoing. The Onondaga filed a land rights action, I think, about 5 or 6 years ago. And what they asked for was not land returned, not money for the land that was taken. They asked simply to have a voice at the table in environmental decisions. And I think that what you're pointing to engages seeing the vision of an indigenous world in balance and harmony, not some kind of, romanticized, but a real working confederacy, which is what the Haudenosaunee still remain today. They're a real working confederacy. Democracy works, and it's happening on our soil. And women choose the chiefs still today, and, it's a balance of authority. And I think it's also starting from the place of being in harmony with earth, with the land. The Thanksgiving address that starts every ceremony is placing human beings in a grateful attitude with every other living thing. And it can last 5 days. It can last a shorter amount of time. But it's a way that before you begin thinking about solving any problems or doing any work together, you orient yourself and you understand that you're part of this natural world that gives you everything that you need to survive. That attitude can save the planet. Western thought and attitudes are going to destroy the world. Indigenous thinking is the only thing I'm convinced today that can save the planet.
And you don't have to go to Avatar and see all the technical razzmatazz to understand that. Anyway, Sally Reschweiner, I'm looking at the clock, and I don't think we're going to have time to get to her son-in-law in the phenomenal Oz series, which I think is totally an extension. And real quickly, Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. I love that story. And could you real quickly do that?
I'll do it as quick as I can. And I'd love to tell people that I'm coming to St. Pete.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. But we want to tell them you're coming Sunday, March 21st.
Yes. Uh-huh. At 2:30 to 4, bring a teacup and a saucer to share. And we will be doing our own sort of tea party, I guess, and dialoguing. We really want to enlist people, our friends in St. Pete and new friends in how can we tell the story of Gage in her home in Fayetteville as we're getting it restored. It's at the Unitarian Universalist Church, St. Pete, on the 21st Sunday, as you said, 719 Arlington Avenue North. And for more about Gage, www.MatildaJocelynGage.org, and people can get in touch with me through that website as well.
It's a phenomenal website. I spent a lot of time there yesterday, and it really just was really, truly coming alive. And some of your video speeches, Sally, they're wonderful. So I really recommend people to spend some time there and then maybe pick up Gage's book, which is still readily available, Woman, Church, and State by Matilda Jocelyn Gage, with an afterword edited by you, Sally Reschweiner. And so anyway, but real quickly, because I know I have to go on here, but the Wizard of Oz, Dorothy.
Well, the son-in-law of Matilda Jocelyn Gage was L. Frank Baum, and she's the one who encouraged him to write the stories. She's the one who said, they're great. They're such a vision. Now, it really was, in many ways, her vision of a transformed world. She lived with the Baums every winter for the last 14 years of her life. They were reading the same books, thinking the same thoughts. She was his intellectual mentor. If only people know the movie, they don't know Oz. He wrote 14 books. And by the third book, it's a matriarchy. It's based on peace. Everybody gives what they can and gets what they need. Dorothy, I think, is this character. And this is a story that comes out of the family. Before Gage died, she had a near-death experience, and she became absolutely certain that there was an afterlife. You know, she passed over, she saw her parents and people that had died, her husband, and she came back to life, and she knew then that there was something that went on afterwards. She writes to her grandson, 6 months before she dies, "We are more alive in death than ever we are in life. We come back. Sometimes to the same family, sometimes to another." She believed in reincarnation. When she died, her daughter-in-law was pregnant. This would be the last child in the Gage line. And when the child was born, 3 months after Matilda's, or 4 months after Matilda's death, she wasn't healthy. And she lived only a few months. When Maud, Matilda's daughter, and her the wife of L. Frank Baum, when Maud went to the funeral, she said she missed her mother so much, she was just desperate. And she said, "Dorothy was the most beautiful child I've ever seen. I could have loved her as my very own." Maud had 4 sons. She never had a daughter. When her mother died, she lost that long, deep, close relationship, mother-daughter, and she had no one to pass that on to. The family mythology, perhaps Dorothy is the spirit of Matilda Jocelyn Gage, born after her death. Dorothy is clearly a Gage woman. In the books, she is the most independent, the most self-defining. Quite frankly, Judy Garland's character is a wimp compared to the Dorothy of the book. And I think that perhaps in the family mythology, Matilda Jewel Gage, the granddaughter of Matilda Jocelyn Gage, and the niece of L. Frank Baum, at one point said to me, "I often wonder if Uncle Frank didn't name Dorothy for my sister." And through that, through extension, perhaps, he was honoring his mother-in-law when he named the major character Dorothy and released the spirit of Matilda Jocelyn Gage into the world. He published The Wonderful Wizard of Oz 2 years after Matilda died, and he was writing it when she was passing.
Well, Sally Rush Wagner, I cannot thank you enough for you really keeping Matilda Jocelyn Gage in front of us. This is a woman that speaks to us more today than ever, and I think we'll speak to our daughters and our granddaughters. A visionary. Without her, I can't imagine the women's movement being where it is today. And so we will so look forward to your coming again Sunday, March 21st. You're going to be at the UU Church. And if you found this conversation interesting today, listeners, just wait till you get Sally up there without me bothering her with questions. So, Sally,
Mary, it's been a delight. It's so refreshing and so exciting to visit with somebody who understands Gage so well and has such a deep concept of the work that she was doing. I feel like you enlightened me today. Thank you.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. But you know, when you've got the kind of spirit that Matilda Jocelyn Gage was. I really thought when I've been reading her, Sally, I thought, my word, if she were a man, this would be one of the most, her ideas would be so well known, and I think would be such integrated so much more into our society. But then I thought, you know, being a woman and dealing with it, with women's kind of being, in a way that she didn't have to worry totally about her ideas being modified or molliated, you know, in the whole political process. And so, in a way, she was free to roam all everything that she came in contact with. And so, in a way,
thought of that.
Yeah, we get a totally open vision. And I find when I read her, she's still going. And in other words, there are some minds you read that you're fascinated with the idea, but it's complete in itself. And you deal with it and you mull it over, and that's great. But there are some really fantastic minds that it's active. It's still there. And so I thought, you know, if she had not been a woman, I don't think we'd have Gage's vision in the same way and so alive. And so this is why I so encourage particularly young women to read her, because she will take you, and it's kind of like a Magritte ladder. You know, you get there and then you're free to fly. You know, you're in an area you'd never be if this person didn't give you a ladder, but then you fly. And to me, that's what vision is. And I don't call many people really visionary, and she really is a visionary, because to me, she's very much alive. And so, anyway, Sally Rushbrenner, that's how I see her.
Thank you, Mary, for that. That's an amazing analysis. I have never thought of that. And I think you're absolutely right. I'm going to be chewing on that. Now until I get to St. Pete, and I hope we have a chance to visit about it
tomorrow. Oh, indeed we will. And it's so exciting. It really is. And I just think that this woman has so much for us. So I hate to say goodbye to you, but I realize I really need to. And so, because we have another interview, we're going to quickly get through. So, Sally, thank you so much, Russ Wagner, for giving me this time today. Matilda Jocelyn Gage lives, and I hope she even becomes better known than she is.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.